The COVID crash of March led to the quickest bear market in history and back to the quickest bull market in history. If you've weathered four or five market crashes, you can speak with some authority about financial crises. But what lessons can be learned from a panel of four seasoned professionals who have witnessed multiple historic troughs and peaks? Is there a specific skill set to react effectively in uncertain times? Well, for an investor mindset masterclass, we've invited Sasfin Securities Deputy Chairman David Shapiro, who is joined by Sasfin Fund Managers Bruce Ackerman and Errol Shear, and Liston Mankies, who is now independent but has had a storied career in investment management, at one time with Sasfin as well, and who is in New Zealand currently, to unpack the differences in the crisis. Since the stock market crashes in the 80s, a recession in the early 90s, a mini stock market crash in the late 90s, the dot-com bubble, and then the US bear markets between 2007 and 2009. Guys, welcome. Kia ora, Liston, I think they say in Kiwi. David, kick us off, and I hope you've recovered from that pothole. Speaking of which, it does feel like investors face a potholed road ahead, as we've seen the recent tech pullback in the US has just reminded us that markets offshore don't rise in a straight line. And here at home, we've seen some real action on SA Inc., as they call it, in the last day or so. But there's all of these risks around. There's US elections, there's inflation that's gone AWOL. What can we learn from these past market crises that will help investors equip themselves with the right skills to navigate this uncertain and volatile time?
One could say it in one sentence: just stay the course. And I think that if you would have stayed the course from when we joined, I came in the aftermath of the 1969 crash and that. But, you know, if one had just stayed in equities from that time and not be bothered by these ups and downs, you actually come out on top. And I still think that still remains the course at the moment, even though we're seeing a bit of a sell-off in tech at the moment. These are very, very strong businesses generating lots of earnings. So don't be bothered by this. So before you get on to everybody else, listen to what Buffett says. You know, just turn on the TV once a year. You'll be fine.
And put us out of business. Don't listen to us talking heads who like to sell advertising on the back of this daily market talk. Listen, from your vantage point, I mean, you once gave a talk on the crash of 69. I'm giving your age away a little bit here. Is this time different? There's that famous saying in markets, this time is different, and it never is. This time does feel a little bit different, though.
Oh, definitely. You know, if you look at the political and economic environment then, and particularly it was a crash in South Africa in 69, not really worldwide, and it was caused by a hothouse effect. And again, it was very like the dot-com bubble. You know, pricing just got absolutely to levels that could not be sustained. And then eventually there was nobody left to buy. Times got a bit tougher, and suddenly, and it took quite a long time to recover from that. Similarly, you know, when we had the crash of 87, I can remember somebody asking me and saying, how long do you think it will last? And I said, you know, when you get a crash like this, a lot of people, particularly fund managers, don't feel safe until they've built up their cash reserves to a reasonable level. You know, and that will take, and I did some calculation, and I said 6 months, and blow me down, it was about 6 months later when it actually did bottom out and started climbing. Now, this time, and worldwide, it was not for reasons of overvaluation or government action. You know, this was a totally left field, predictable in the sense that, you know, it's a black swan event. We haven't seen one, but we think they could exist. And blow me down, you know, COVID arrived. And I think, you know, there was a lot of government action which prevented it from being an absolute catastrophe in the markets. What it's done, though, is being somewhat of a disaster in economies. And so the old belief that, you know, economies lead markets is totally out of the window.
It's an event-driven crisis, to hear you describe it like that, rather than a systemic crisis. My concern might be, and I think for many investors as well, is that the response to that event may have caused something of a deeper, more structural crisis in the economy. Errol, I suppose the one thing that doesn't change from crisis to crisis is the human element. There are humans involved in the trade every time. It's greed or it's fear that drives things.
There are always only two things that drive markets. One is the fear of losing money at start, and then greed to try and make lots of money when you think the market has bottomed. The only big difference I can see here between this market, this called correction, crash, whatever you want to call it, the only big difference is the speed with which the stock market has recovered. It took weeks for the markets to go back to where they were before the crash. But the other difference is the economies will take longer to recover. So the big difference between this and, let's say, the great financial crisis was that was a short, well, that was a financial crisis. This is a true economic crisis. But the market has reacted as if nothing is of a long-term nature. And that is the worry. Has the market recovered far too quick given the enduring nature of the economic contraction we'll experience? Most economists see the African economy taking several years to recover. We might have over-discounted the recovery in the economy here.
That's an important point. If we look locally at the recent rebound we've seen this week in SA Inc. in particular, anything that happens to not just be listed here and earn offshore, but listed here and have a big focus on the South African economy and have exposure to a macro that has been terrible for years now. And I think we all know the reasons for that. Bruce, the other thing is that the only thing we seem to learn from history is that we don't learn from history. And so we need to actually look back at the previous market crises, and to David's point, learn how to stay the course. It's difficult, though, when you have markets plunging, people just want to rush for the exits and go into cash. And equally on the other side, when you see the tech rally, you had these Robinhood traders and everyone was leveraging up without much experience. So you have that human element still. What are the important lessons that you think we should learn from previous market crashes?
Yes, well, as Errol indicated, this crash is different because you've had no financial crisis, because after the 2008 global financial crisis, the banks had to carry far more capital in relation to their loans than they had before. And so, in effect, they were prepared for something like this, plus the fact that governments have given unprecedented support this time round, which wasn't the case to this vast extent in 2008. But what you've seen significantly and what you've mentioned now is that you've seen a lot of private trader speculation, especially from in America, where it's driven these tech stocks, Tesla being the poster child of that, to inordinate levels without much in the way of earnings yet. But because this is a new economy, everyone is optimistic about it. And you've seen a complete bifurcation of markets insofar as old economy stocks, or shall we say the value stocks, have significantly underperformed the overall market. Because in America, the top five or six tech stocks account for a quarter of the market, which is of concern. So therefore, how does one navigate this situation? It's by paying attention to valuations, but in relation to the expected future growth of earnings from the companies you're looking at. And also, to the extent, again, I must endorse the idea that the economies, especially in the hospitality, leisure, travel-related side, will not recover. And these are labor-intensive areas where people's incomes are involved. And savings have been built up in many places in Europe, UK in particular, and US, because people haven't been able to spend as much as they've been previously doing. And therefore, this does support future consumption as long as people are confident enough to go out and about again.
It's one of those markets that it does feel different from that perspective. Dave, to bring you in here on this question on US tech in particular, there's this acronym that's bandied about TINA, there is no alternative, because interest rates are so low, the yields you're getting on government bonds are just not that attractive. So all this capital has been flooding into tech, and that's really driven a lot of these valuations as well. That makes me a little bit nervous.
Well, you've got to choose your bubble. You know, which bubble do you want? Do you want the bond bubble? You can have that, where you can go into U.S. treasuries at 0.6% with inflation at 1.6, gives you a negative real return. So, in other words, you're losing money all the time by investing. Or you can choose the tech bubble, where you've got some really quality companies who are increasing their earnings double digit each year, or even if it's high single digit, I can live with that, but it's more likely to be double digit. So they're generating huge amounts of cash, which they're reinvesting into buying other companies and expanding their business base. So yes, they might be stretched a little, but I don't think it's going to stop. I think tech companies are dominating. And what's interesting, against the backdrop that, you know, Bruce has painted, Liston has painted, Errol, whoever, you know, all of us, you know, against that backdrop, these are companies that are still going to endure and do well simply because we're using them even in this difficult situation. So I'm very nervous of the old value plays, because I think when we come out of this, companies are going to have to reevaluate their business models. And I think the value businesses are going to be the ones that are going to have to look a lot more carefully than some of these tech businesses.
That's very interesting. And listen, this week, ShopRite, almost this old world value play of a consumer-facing retailer, in a very interesting slide showed that it's meeting this new world tech environment in its 60/60 app, and we've seen the huge growth of that and home delivery using a platform, using online technology. So increasingly we're seeing a convergence between sort of new world tech and old world shares as well. How does that then feed into the way investors need to be analyzing which are those companies they want to back to be the future winners?
Well, again, it comes back to one of the things I said earlier. You know, often market crashes are caused by, you know, inordinately high, what we call price earnings ratios. And, you know, I can remember when the Nikkei was at its height in 1989, the telegraph company, Nippon Telephone and Telegraph, was trading on a price earnings multiple of 300. Now, when you see that, you say crash coming. And it did. If you look now, you know, even Tesla, it's very highly rated, but it's on about 150 times earnings. But everybody believes their earnings are coming and they're going to do some wonderful things. Now, that's a debate, and it is truly how some people evaluate. But I would say that's one of the things that's different this time. Whenever I hear or read news articles, it beat expectation. It was better than some idea that had been put out, and they don't refer to these price earnings multiples. They vary, and of course they are related to interest rates. So that's where this time it is really different, and it plays out exactly the way that people have said. If your choice is getting 0.6% for the next 10 years, or buying your own shares back, companies will buy their own shares back. But obviously, The big statement comes, you know, at what price are you prepared to buy things back? And so the game goes on, and exactly the point that is being made is that eventually, you know, something which has got solid earnings, proper company business model, and is in sync with the world at the moment. So something like Netflix, I'm not, by the way, but it's on a price earnings multiple of 90 times. You might say, I think that's a bit heavy, but other people say no. Because of COVID, lots of people want to stay home. They'll happily pay for it. Their client base is growing. You know, I want that one at 90. So there was a little bit of an answer to your question of, you know, how do you value companies like that? But come bring it back to the dot-com. There was no such way of valuing, because a lot of the companies didn't have any earnings at all.
We've got the awesome foursome in the Zoom room. Errol, we're talking about valuations and sticking offshore here with the US and the NASDAQ. And looking at the forward PE for the NASDAQ, it's 20.8 versus the current 30.4, which suggests that if we were to be in the midst of something of a correction, it's still got some way to go. But I reckon, and to David Shapiro's point, that because there is no alternative, because there is this TINA, I doubt whether or not we're going to go back to that long-term average. What is your view on offshore tech, and what some of the downside risks, and also what some of the upside drivers might be?
Okay, if you look at the U.S. market, you can argue the P.E. ratio is on the high side, but it's not hugely so. But one of the concerns is the big driver of the P.E.s going upwards has been this flood of money which the Fed has pushed into the system. Lower cost of capital means that you can value, on a good sound academic basis, you can value all shares on a higher multiple based on the lower cost of capital. Can that continue forever? One of my big fears is that what the Fed is doing and what the ECB is doing and what the bank is doing, pumping money into the system, is this just a giant Ponzi scheme? Are we going to look back in 10 years' time or 20 years' time and say this is all funny money? It pushed up prices of assets, all assets, or most assets, mainly tech assets, because there was no other place to invest your money. Is it sustainable long term? Now, that is a long term concern. I don't think that's a concern in the next 6 months, next 12 months, next 3 years even. But long term, that is a concern. And certainly, if you look at the US tech companies that are producing earnings growth, there are three drivers of returns in the long term. One is the rating. And as we said earlier, the P rating on average in the US market is only slightly over. The other component of rating is dividend yield. And dividend yield in the USA, 1.6% average dividend yield. It's been higher in the past, but it's not too bad. And the other component of return, the third component, is growth. And while these companies are producing growth, you can expect the ratings to continue. So I'm not sure in a bubble yet, but long term, this whole flood of cash going into the system from the Fed must end up in a major correction at some stage in the markets.
I want to bring it home to SA Inc. as it's known now. And Bruce, locally, do you see any top-down or bottom-up catalysts to drive a re-rating in South Africa at the moment? Certainly a vaccine seems to be a top-down catalyst. If we get a vaccine and we start to see economic activity return much quicker to normal, that's a big one. What are any others that you might see to force a re-rating in South Africa?
Well, first of all, just to address Errol's comments that overall world markets are dependent on inflation not returning, and valuations are dependent, therefore, on low, longer-term bond deals. And those would certainly escalate if all this funny money he refers to comes home to roost and central banks have to clamp down if there is inflation. Now, that's not in the near term, but that is a concern for the future, which is partly why gold has been escalating, and that's obviously still of some significance to the South African economy, not as much as it used to be. Numbers are now platinum exports are more important. But the issue really is, can these low long-term bond yields continue to prevail? And in South Africa, you've got a particular opportunity because long-term bond yields are just about in double figures, which is atypical for the rest of the world, which indicates that either there is a concern over the government's financing, which there certainly would be, given the almost 100% of GDP deficit, which is forecast because of the pandemic. And secondly, also because foreigners are somewhat leery of lending money to South Africa, bearing in mind the instability of the rand and given the fact that our government initiatives don't inspire too much confidence. But the South African market is a dual market. There are domestic stocks and international stocks. The international stocks predominate because they've done not so much better because they're not dependent on the fairly stagnant South African economy. So the outlook here is really more for the foreign dominated stocks, which admittedly are on higher PE ratings than the local ones, because the ones which are dependent on the local economy are going to struggle because interest rates have fallen here now. But we have a structurally higher inflation rate than the rest of the world. Why? Because the unions are strong and there are lots of inefficiencies in the system. And so that means a major headwind continues for the South African economy, even if the rand does weaken, which can obviously help the export industries. So I don't see a particular silver lining in South Africa. I'd certainly focus on foreign, either foreign companies themselves or those South African companies with substantial foreign interests.
Mm, they just happen to be listed here. David, yep. on the SA Inc. story, we've just seen this week a flood back into SA Inc., which feels like a lot of local money. I don't know if it's foreigners coming in just yet. I don't think there's enough for them to say, oh, the president's got a handle on corruption and he's going to push through reforms. Eskom's still a problem. How do you see the top-down and the bottom-up drivers in SA Inc.?
I think just adding on to what Bruce has said, I'm not going to go into the structure of our, you know, of our economy. But if we do go down and start looking at SA Inc., I'm still concerned. At the end, Michael, it's nominal GDP that will drive activity in the economy, and we were already negative. We were already in recession before we went into the situation, and it's only going to be worse this year, probably the next two or three years. So you're not going to get that driver that's going to create activity with the banks or even follow through in employment to where consumption will flow through to the retailer. So I'm concerned. I know that there are, you know, value investors are licking their chops and saying this is it. You know, things are really great. You know, it's a wonderful time to be a value investor. But I think, yes, there'll be a short-term bounce. You know, we'll see a short-term bounce, which always happens. But for sustainable earnings, in other words, to build on the kind of growth that we'll see with a big turnaround, I'm very, very concerned. I think structurally, it's going to hang back on us. It's going to be very difficult for us to do well in SA Inc., you know, given 2, 3, 4 years down the line.
Yeah, Pitful Yun is having his time in the sun, so let's not take that away from him just yet. Listen, when we look at the fundamentals, company earnings now, and you talk often when I talk to you about earnings estimates and beats, but what we have seen, because often an earnings estimate can just be set so low that you'd have to trip over it to be able to beat it. But what we are seeing in the company results and the earnings so far is that companies are reporting a common feature. On aggregate, trading has been better at the end of their financial year end, as we've seen the economy restrictions eased. And I suppose the big question is this sustainable? Is it just pent-up demand in certain sectors? And does that potentially point to a bit of a quicker recovery supporting SA Inc.? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, no, I think, you know, the whole point about it is that certain companies are in what I would call semi-monopolistic situations. So when we had lockdowns, only some of the supermarkets were able to open and be able to do deliveries and the rest. There are certainly a lot of people who were in the smaller areas who are unable to benefit and, in fact, struggled and probably won't make it out. There's certainly a whole lot on the hospitality, tourism side that will not see the light of day. And I'm not saying this just for South Africa. I think the same is true here in New Zealand. So, you know, governments have stepped in and they've helped, they've given support to the workers. This has kind of been universal around the world. Never seen anything like it in my time. It's not in any textbook I've seen. I mean, I can remember people telling me how we got our way out of the depression was to create jobs where people moved the dunes of Durban Point down to Greyville Racecourse, and they were paid 50 or 6 pence a day or 6 pence an hour, and we got out of the mess that way. So, you know, there was an idea of job creation to get your way out of it. And so I would say you will not see any sustainable rise until we can get that move back to where we were, and I think that will take an incredibly long time, largely because of complexities, and I don't have to you know, roll the drum. It is Eskom, it is SAA, all the state-owned enterprises, as it were. And if you just look at the proportion the government is of the economy already, to become an even greater portion of that has to rely on borrowings or tax. And you're eroding your tax base. You're making it difficult for foreigners to lend. I am not a fan.
Not a fan of SA Inc. Not many are at the moment. Errol Scheer, I'll leave you with the last word quickly. And to use this narrative of sticking the course that David mentioned in the introduction, how do we avoid the potholes that are inevitably going to crop up, be it a US election that might not go the way the market expects or a delay in a vaccine? What's your final word of advice for investors to avoid those potholes but stay on the road?
Always keep a balance. Never put all your eggs into one basket. It's the old things. Diversify into different markets, different types of stocks, different asset classes, property, equity. Property may be lesser at the moment, but certainly equity and fixed interest, especially in South Africa, where fixed interest rates are good.
Well, there we go. Let's hope it's not carrying coal to Newcastle. Speaking of which, I know Eskom can certainly do with some coal at the moment. That was your Markets Masterclass with Sasfin Securities Deputy Chairman David Shapiro, Fund Managers Bruce Ackerman and Errol Scheer, and Lisa Mainchies over in New Zealand.